This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women that if you take the time to talk to them, you're going to find out they've done some pretty incredible things for the sake of our freedom. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The gentleman we're going to speak to today is a Navy veteran of World War II, 88-year-old George Chrisman of Northridge, California. I want to thank his daughter, Linda, for letting me know about his story. Now, you're pretty proud of your daughter, I bet. How long was she in the Navy?
She was in the Navy about 27 years.
27 years, and I bet she outranks you.
She did. She came out a commander.
Uh-huh.
And I was only second class.
But why do I have a feeling she might not have gone into the Navy if it wasn't for you?
She wanted to do everything Daddy did.
I guess so. And I guess there's a little element of that in your story, because you grew up here in Southern California, growing up in Hawthorne. Your father was a World War I veteran.
Yes.
Not of the Navy, though.
No, Army.
Did he ever tell you what he did in World War I?
No.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Were you ever curious?
Oh, not really. I didn't know much about it then.
Uh-huh. So you're born in 1927. That tells me you were about 14 years old when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. You remember that day, December 7th, 1941?
Yes, very much so.
Tell me what you remember about that day. Where were you and how'd you find out?
We were in the house and everything was told to black out. Don't go outside. Keep everything dark.
Was that a little spooky?
It is spooky when you're 14 years old. Somebody's attacking your country.
Were you envisioning the Japanese bombers coming over Los Angeles?
Yes, sir. It was very, very, you know, run out, walk, sneak outside and see, look up in the sky, see if you see anything.
Uh-huh. For so many of us who weren't alive back then, it's hard to fathom that kind of atmosphere here in the United States. Maybe people think of 9/11 and they can identify a little bit. But what was it like in the weeks and months that followed in Los Angeles?
Very scary. My father was one of those home guards. He had the rifle and he'd walk out on the road and walk up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have to stay in the house.
And you're obviously a teenager. You're just starting high school at the time. Did you have any Japanese-American friends?
Yes.
What happened to them in the months that followed?
Most of those were taken to encampment.
Was that hard when they were taken away to the internment camps? Was that kind of mystifying for you?
You can't understand what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
My father-in-law up in Oregon was telling me about they had people up there that were radioing all the positions of the aircraft factories, et cetera, around Los Angeles.
Mm.
And they had a radio station up there. And after they captured them, they couldn't figure out what to do. And they figured that that's when they took all the Japanese and encamped them, because they couldn't control them.
And I guess if you lived during the time, it was understandable.
Yes, it was.
Now it's, for people in today's world, it's kind of hard to understand.
It's hard to understand why they took them all.
Yeah. And I'm sure you saw them as schoolmates, right? You didn't think they were sinister or anything?
No. You didn't feel any danger with them.
Mm-hmm. When did it start to weigh on your mind that there's a war going on and maybe you should do something about it?
As the Japanese were progressing, it would get worse and worse and worse and worse, and they were taking this and that and the other thing, pretty soon be here in the United States.
So you decided you wanted to get in?
I wanted to get in and do what I could for the country.
And how'd your parents feel about that?
They'd backed me up, and they thought that was a good idea.
So you actually went to sign up for the Navy before you even turned 17?
Right.
And your parents signed for you?
Parents signed for me. 2 days after I was 17, I went out boot camp down in San Diego.
Uh-huh. I know that's a long time ago. But do you remember what your expectations were, what you thought the Navy was going to be like?
I thought I'd be on the ship. But after I went to San Diego and went to radio school, went to Oceanside to become in the Beach Party Team 62. We had to learn landings and stuff like that to work with the Beachmaster and be his communication system, because he's the one that led all the landings. Unloaded all the ships.
And we've had a few gentlemen on this program over the years who were what at that time were called frogmen. Now we call them Navy SEALs.
Right.
How similar was what you were doing then to what we know now as a Navy SEAL?
Well, after we landed on Okinawa, and most of the demolition team, they call them demolition team, was killed. They felt the beach party team, who was going to go ashore, could do the demolition team and then go ashore and do the same thing. So they sent us to Maui to learn the training of the underwater demolition, how to blow channelways and all those kind of things.
And we'll get to that, you getting to Okinawa. But you mentioned radio school and these different trainings that you were experiencing. I understand you still can handle Morse code. If you had to interpret some right now, if you heard all the dots and the diz and all that noise making, you would know what it was?
Very well.
Could you give us your name in Morse code or something else in Morse code?
A day to remember. It's did-a, da-did-it, did-a, da-did-a-da, da do da da did-a, dit, dit, da-da, dit, da-da, did-a, da ba da did it dit, did-a, dit.
And that's it.
A day to remember.
I can't call you a liar.
Most of the Navy has gone away from Morse code now.
Yeah, but back then you realized it was going to be essential for communication.
Oh, yes.
Were you eager to get overseas and be a part of this?
I wanted to do what I could for our country.
And you actually had a sister who ended up in the Navy in World War II as well,
My sister ended up in the Waves.
Uh-huh. Where was she? What did she do?
She went to Long Beach and worked with the chaplain there.
Uh-huh.
Handled all of in and out people that were being shipped out.
So, 17 years old, in the Navy, 1944, when you finally headed overseas, what do you remember about that? Were you scared? Were you nervous? Were you excited? What do you remember?
You're excited, but you're scared. It took a long time on the ship to get to Hawaii, where we based, and then from there we flew to Johnson Island, Kwajalein Island, Guam, and then to Leyte to load ships there for the Okinawa invasion.
So Leyte was already secure.
Yes.
And you guys were there to prepare for this massive invasion at Okinawa, which oftentimes is forgotten or overshadowed, even though it was the big battle at the end of World War II in the Pacific. And you were there from the beginning.
Right.
The first day, Easter Sunday.
Easter Sunday.
April 1, 1945.
Right.
So are you 18 years old yet? You're still 17?
No, 18.
When's your birthday?
January.
Okay.
We didn't land until April 1st.
Yeah, so you're 18 years old, Easter Sunday. Walk me through that day. What do you remember? What was the first thing that happened that day?
That day, we climbed out of the cargo ship, down the cargo nets, loaded ourselves onto them Amtraks because they weren't sure what the beach was. We get into the beach with the ship. So we went on the Amtraks. We gathered out. It was still dark. Gathered around a big circle. We had Easter sunrise service there with the chaplain. And after the chaplain had the Easter sunrise service, we left for the beach. And about that time, my commander, the beachmaster, had his radio, and all the big ships started shelling the beach where we were going to land to clear it further. And then as soon as we got near the beach, stopped that shelling, and the Amtrak continued on. The Army went ashore. About the third wave, we went ashore, dug our foxholes, set up the radio communications and beach markers, and started unloading ships. Very scary.
I would imagine so, and a pretty important role in that invasion. But you said the first thing you guys did was you had an Easter sunrise service. The chaplain led the way with that. Do you remember anything about what was said there or what that meant to you to start that day that way?
Nope. It's scary.
Yeah. I imagine you felt like you were going to need some extra protection.
Oh, yes. Very much so.
And so you talk about the beachmaster and this landing party. So basically your guy's job was to get there first and set up some kind of organization so all these waves and waves and waves of troops coming ashore would be organized and going in the right direction.
Right.
Is that right?
The beachmaster's job is to direct that landing.
Uh-huh. It sounds like a pretty dangerous job too, though.
Well, yes, it is.
Did you guys come under enemy fire?
Yes. We had a lot of Japanese up there in the mountains that were shooting at us.
Uh-huh. So what did you do?
Duck.
You had a foxhole and you...
Yeah, but the foxhole was only about a foot deep.
That doesn't do much good.
Because you had hard pan.
Uh-huh.
So you dug whatever you could and you lay down in there, and then it rained and we got full of water and didn't worry about the water. Just get down in there.
I'm trying to imagine myself in your shoes here. You're 18 years old. You're in a foxhole on the beach at Okinawa and Japanese shells are coming in.
Well, the shells weren't coming in. It was just small fire.
Just small arms fire. But you're still feeling a little danger there.
Yes, especially at night.
And there's not a whole lot you can do to protect yourself, is there?
No.
So what goes through your mind when you're in that foxhole and you still hear these rounds going off around you?
Hope you live for the next day. And when that first day, we looked up there and it was a little house about 50 yards or 100 yards away, they were flying the Japanese flag.
Mm-hmm.
So about three of us went up there, and first we called in for an American flag to be sent in. They sent the flag in. When they got the flag, we went over took the flagpole down. It's one of those flagpoles where you pull a pin out and the whole pole comes down.
Mm-hmm.
And we took the flag down. We put the American flag up and put the flag back, pole back up. And that little house that was there, we didn't know it at the time, but there was a guy up on the roof was shooting at a pair of people. So eventually, after we had the American flag up, we went up there with a couple of hand grenades and blew up the whole building. And he was down on the ground, dead. No,
but you didn't
shell.
Know he was there when you were taking the flag.
No.
He could have killed you.
Oh, yeah. And then after I took the flag down, I put the flag in my pocket. You got those jumbo pockets, and put it in my pocket. When I got back on the ship 4 days later, I still had this flag.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got home, I put it in my treasure chest, and my daughter was going through my stuff for 4 or 5 years. Well, it's been about 10 years now. And she found this flag. Said, "What's this flag, Dad?" And I told her. I said, "That's the one we took off a flagpole in Okinawa." And so I folded it up and put it away, and I still got the flag now.
And I imagine there were a few American servicemen, whether they were Navy like you or Army or Marines or even Army Air Corps, that ended up on Okinawa, because that was a long, drawn-out battle over a lot of territory. There are probably quite a few of them that ended up bringing a flag of some kind back. But my guess is yours might be the first one. Could anyone have grabbed the flag on Okinawa before you did?
Any one of the three that took it down. I cut it off because it was tied onto the pole.
Yeah, but so there were three of you, but there was only one flag.
Right.
So you got that flag, and I'm just saying timeline-wise, because this is the first day of the battle, and you're in there early on, you were probably the first American to take a Japanese flag on Okinawa.
Right.
Yeah.
Like Iwo Jima, they had Marines, they had photographers.
Yep.
Okinawa was Army. They didn't have photographers.
So you could have been part of a Joe Rosenthal photo if Rosenthal was there to take it.
Yeah.
What, and we'll talk more about that flag and how it's come back around and led to some other developments in more recent history. But what was the significance of that for you, to cut down this Japanese flag, not just to take it for yourself, but to put up in its place the Stars and Stripes?
That's amazing. A lot of memories go by there. I look back at that flag and salute it and say, "Oh, there's my flag.
Mm-hmm.
That's our country."
And there was a long way to go in that battle.
Oh, yes. 10,000 a day was being killed.
And you'd be back on the ship for most of it.
Yeah.
But you did see some. So the first day on Okinawa, you're one of the first in. You take this flag. Still the Japanese are firing on you guys. How long did that day feel? We hear about June 6th of 44 and those guys who hit the beach at Normandy, and they call that the longest day. But how long of a day was April 1, 1945 for you?
Seemed like it never ended.
Yeah?
Especially about dusk. When it got dusk, it was about 50 Japanese planes coming over, those kamikaze pilots. Oh, it just blackened the sky. And here they come, and you just jump in and dive into your foxhole. Here come the Beachmaster down the way, and he tripped over one of the wires from the beach marker.
Uh-huh.
And when he tripped over it, he fell, tipped over it. You know, he used to be a football player. So he went over, and his helmet fell off. He gathered up the helmet, put it on his head, dove into his water-filled foxhole. I can still see that big, tall guy diving in that foxhole, holding his helmet on his arm.
Uh-huh.
And these planes were terrible noise, and they couldn't get any planes off because it was just about dusk, and they didn't get any planes off. So all the ships at sea were firing.
So you have a pretty good seat for this show.
Yeah.
The ships are close enough to shore that you can see them.
Oh, yeah.
And you see the kamikazes attacking them. Is that a bit of a helpless feeling? Do you find yourself cheering?
Nothing you can do.
Yeah.
Just pray that you don't get hit.
Yeah. And pray those guys out on the ships are safe.
Because they've got some of those planes were hitting right near the beach, blowing
mm-hmm.
up.
Mm-hmm. Did you lose any friends that day?
No. Luckily, we were on the beach and the Army was moving ahead.
Uh-huh.
We had friends that got shot, but that's about it.
Uh-huh.
I got hit one time in my hand, but that's a small shell, you know, a small arm. So
it was that day or
reach
no?
Down, yeah. Reach down, pull it out with your teeth because it burns. It burns like it's on fire.
Okay, you're saying that like it's not a big deal, but the rest of us, for the most part, have not been in these kind of situations. So you're 18 years old. You're on the beach on the first day of one of the biggest battles in the history of the world, and a bullet hits you?
Yep. You're scared.
Well, yeah, I would think so. We need to catch our first break right now, but when we come back, we'll try to get to the bottom of that. It happens so often on this show, but it never ceases to amaze me how these veterans refer to life-threatening situations as if they were just some run-of-the-mill experience. Check out the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for a video of George Chrisman and that flag he captured on the first day of the Battle of Okinawa. And keep it right here, because Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 88-year-old George Chrisman of Northridge, California. He was there with Beach Party Team 62 for the opening days of the Battle of Okinawa in April of 1945. That's a battle that would last for 81 days, see more than 7,000 Americans killed and approximately 40,000 more wounded. Before we hit the break, George told us about getting hit by Japanese fire. He felt a burning bullet in his wrist and used his teeth to get it out. I think we need to explore that situation a little more. So how did that happen? What were you doing at the time?
Probably on the radio.
Yeah? So you're trying to direct troops who are still coming into shore?
Yeah, and call for whatever supplies they needed.
Uh-huh. That sounds like a pretty chaotic scene. It's probably just go, go, go?
It is go, go, go. You don't sleep for 3-4 days.
Literally.
You're up all night long calling the radio. And you might nap, but that's about it.
As troops come ashore, they keep moving inland, but you're staying there to keep things moving and coordinate what's happening. But in that job, you're on the radio, and did you know people were shooting at you, or did you just feel it out of nowhere?
You could hear them.
You could hear guns going off.
Yeah, the Japanese, they'd had the cliff up there. It was mountains, and they had dug in big shelters up on the cliffs, and they had trails. They packed the dead bodies they packed in front as a guard.
Uh-huh.
So they were looking over the dead bodies. And we ended up going up there and with hand grenades and sneaking up there and throwing the hand grenade in the cave that they had built so it wouldn't be any more small arm fire.
But before that, you actually get hit in the hand.
Yeah. We didn't worry about that. Well, just a small one.
Well, what did it feel like? How did you realize what had happened?
It just burned like somebody hit you with a hot coals.
And you look down at your hand, and what do you see?
It was right here in the wrist.
Your left wrist.
You just reach in there, and nothing else to grab, and so you bite on it, spit it out, and burn your lips. And you do what you have to.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing. I'm picturing this, and again, you're talking about this so mundanely, like this is something that just happens, but you have a bullet that lodges in your wrist, a hot piece of metal.
Yeah.
And you took your teeth and bit in and got it out of there.
Yeah.
You'd never done that before.
Nope. We've been trained, though, for first-line medics because there's no doctors on there.
Uh-huh.
So if somebody gets shot or a shrapnel or whatever, you can do a minor incision and take it out. If they break a bone, you feel with it.
Uh-huh. Like
and you find out what's the matter, and then you tape it up. Most of those guys I don't care. I'm going to go on. Get me well, and I'm going. My job is to fight. Give me my rifle.
So you'd been trained to render first aid if people were injured around you. But is that how you were trained to do it? To bite a bullet out of somebody?
No, you just do what you have to.
So when it hits you, you go ahead and you clamp down on the bullet and pull it out of there and spit it out naturally. Didn't think about saving it for your kids?
Nope.
You weren't thinking about ever being married or having kids at that point.
Saving your life. Your life is more important. Get it out of there.
So what did it look like after you took the bullet out of there? I imagine there's some blood, right?
Yeah, there was blood. It was sore. You push it back together as much as you can and put a bandage over it.
Uh-huh. You had to do that all by yourself?
Yeah. Put a little sulfur formaldehyde in it and bandage it up.
Mm-hmm. Did they give you the Purple Heart?
No, because there was nobody there, no medics.
Uh-huh.
So I got in my paperwork. It was signed by the officer that I had a Purple Heart, but I can't get one because it's not in the medical records.
Really? Does that matter to you? Would you like to have the Purple Heart?
No, that's not a big price.
Well, just the fact that you got hit in the wrist, that's a pretty close call, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's pretty close to the old heart, but it's only a small arms, you know, like a .22 bullet.
Well,
so if it hits a bone, it's going to just smush her. And it's not going to be like a big .30-30 rifles that the Army was using.
Well, still, if it's in the right spot.
Oh, yeah.
That could be it for you.
The neck, the head.
Yeah. So you said you were scared before that happened.
And you're scared after.
More scared?
Oh, yeah.
And you have to keep doing your job.
You do your job.
And you said you guys didn't sleep that whole 4 days you were there?
You'd nap once in a while, but as soon as you go to sleep, there's something going on, blowing up someplace.
How did you do that? What do you think happened inside of you to enable you to carry out those duties, to stay awake, to keep fighting, to doing whatever you were doing?
Just the flow of adrenaline.
Yeah?
Just keeps you moving.
I'm imagining you had never experienced anything quite like that before.
Nope. No. I don't want to do it again.
Yeah. So what were those ensuing days like?
Oh, they tapered off a little bit when the Army kept further in. And the airplanes quit flying over.
Uh-huh.
So it got better. Got a little easier to take.
Was it more challenging in the dark than it was during the daytime?
No, more challenging in the daytime.
Why?
You had more Amtraks coming ashore. Amtraks coming back with somebody that's been shot. And all they want to do is get that bullet out or get that shrapnel out or whatever it is and then go on. They don't even want to give you their name and that and their number. I'd get their name and number and turn it over to their officer so their officer could make sure that they followed up with the medics.
Uh-huh.
If they didn't get any kind of infection or whatever and got properly treated like in a hospital station. And then they put on their record that they'd gotten shot, you know.
Right. So you're helping people go in to battle in advance, but you've also got them coming back wounded. You're processing them. You got them coming and going.
Yeah.
You're a pretty busy guy.
Well, there's not that many.
Were you helping with first aid for some of them too, or only yourself? Okay. So you had to help patch up some other guys.
We had a basic medical training.
Uh-huh.
Where we could do minor incisions and stuff like that. We had a kit there. You had to sharpen your knives and everything. It's not like the knives today are disposable.
Mm-hmm.
You had to sharpen them.
Can you give us an example of some of the things you had to do in caring for those wounded soldiers who came back?
Well, the one tank driver had gotten off his tank, and he'd gone ashore kind of looking around to see where he was going to go, and he stepped on a landmine. It blew his heel. The whole heel just opened up in his shoe. That heel part just opened up, and he come back and he'd got him back on the tank some way, and he came back and he wanted to see what he could do, so he got off and we looked at it and it just peeled off like your sole on your shoe would just peel off, and I opened it up and took the tongue depressors and scraped it out whatever's in there and the blood and stuff, and then I put butterfly bandages. We had to make our own because they didn't have them. We made them out of tape, put that all around it, had to cut his shoe off to start with. And then taped his foot up with an ace bandage. And I said, why don't you just lay down here and we'll get somebody to take you back to the ship. I'm from a farm up in Oregon. He said, I don't need all that kind of stuff. He says, I just get me back on my tank. So he climbed back on the tank and away he went.
Wow.
And I had his name and his number. And I gave that to his officer. And so they checked it later. And about, almost been 40 years later, I was up in Oregon, in Yahats, Oregon,
uh-huh.
where they have a big campground like. My wife's uncle was there, and we went walking to get the mail. And here comes some guy down the road limping, you know, kind of limping, walking away. He's older than I was. He was probably in his 80s, but then come limping around, and he looks at me, and he's about, 100 yards away, but he still sees me, and I hear this guy cussing at me. U.S.O.B., U.S.O.B., you're the one, S.O.B. And my uncle says, what's this? Are we going to get involved in something? I said, I don't know who it is. And I got closer, and he says, you're the S.O.B. that fixed my foot. Because I knew that he was up there, because about 5 years before that, they called me from the Long Beach Naval Hospital. They said, I got a guy there in Yahats, Oregon, that's in the campground, and they want to do his operation on his foot and take some shrapnel out or little pebbles or whatever it is. And he says he won't let anybody touch his foot but you. And I said, well, I'm not qualified. I'm not a doctor. I was just a frontline surgeon. He says, well, then that solves that. And the guy up in Oregon says, nobody's going to touch my foot but George. He had my name. I don't know how he had my name, but they probably told him because I had a name on what I did to his foot.
Right.
And so they called him and told him that I wasn't qualified. And so when I saw him up there, he's cussing me, you're the SOB. And so I had to go up and meet his wife, and she was crying. You saved my husband's foot. He said, if it hadn't been for you, he'd have lost his foot. Mm-hmm. I said, well, we do what we have to. That's not easy.
And that was 40 years after the war, is that what you said? Or maybe longer?
Yeah, at least 40 years after the war.
In all that time, had you ever wondered what happened to him?
Yeah, but then when they called me from the hospital, I knew he was okay.
Until then, you didn't know if he lived or not, probably.
No.
Yeah, because there were a lot of guys that died on Okinawa. How fulfilling was that for you to see him again and understand how much it meant
good.
To him?
It tears my eyes.
I believe it. It's bringing a little water to your eyes right now.
Yep.
Yeah, and probably a few people out there listening. So that's an example. Really, you're kind of a jack of all trades there on this beach in Okinawa.
Well, I've been lucky.
Uh-huh.
The good Lord blessed me with abilities to do a lot of things.
Well, I guess so. And I know Chevron appreciated that for 50 years. You were the guy that could fix anything, even if it was a compressor 10 times the size of the room we're in right now. But again, you're on the beach in Okinawa for just a few days.
About 4 days.
But real intense days.
Oh, every day was intense.
When you look back, is it hard to believe that you did what you did?
Yeah. Hard to believe in my lifetime what I've done.
Sure.
The good Lord blessed me with the abilities to do a lot of things.
I guess so.
I've taught school. I come out of the Navy as a certified diver. I dove for Chevron in many of the countries.
And I want to talk about the diving stuff. But before we wrap up Okinawa, was there anything else that you witnessed or experienced in those 4 days that really stands out to you now?
Just how terrible war is. How much threatening they were to coming to our country. Our United States of America.
You also mentioned the Japanese gun that hit you, that left you that little bullet in your wrist that you had to bite out of there, that you guys negated that threat when you threw a hand grenade into the cave that they were shooting from. Did you go with that party to toss that grenade in?
Yeah, we'd sneak up the walk and pull a pin and throw it in that cave.
That's a little nerve-wracking too, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Makes the chills come to your skin.
Yeah. It's a pretty dangerous duty.
You throw that hand grenade over dead bodies, it's covering the hole. It's scary.
I would say so.
I wouldn't want to do it now. I'm too old.
You mentioned that gentleman whose foot you fixed and the incredible story of reuniting with him all those years later. So you saw guys coming back in that kind of condition. Did you also see dead bodies coming back?
Yeah. They brought them back, stacked them up until they get enough to take them out to sea and dump them.
How hard was that to witness as an 18-year-old?
Terrible.
Is there anything that prepares you for that?
Nope.
How did you deal with it? How did you keep going?
Well, I actually worked for the lifeguards in the summertime. Uh-huh. And you go out and rescue these people that are in riptides and drowning and stuff like that.
Here in Southern California, you did that?
Off Hermosa Beach.
Uh-huh. So coming through in a life-or-death situation was nothing new for you?
No. You do what you can. Do what you have to.
Uh-huh.
What you're trained or what you aren't trained, what comes naturally, I guess you could say.
Yeah, you got to improvise.
God's blessings, you know, you do what you can.
Well, and you mentioned that. You know, I've talked to hundreds of World War II veterans, and some, I just had a guy here recently. He was absolutely convinced that God was going to protect him no matter what. Other guys say, you know, I went through what I went through, and it left me feeling like I wasn't sure there was a God. When you say that God blessed you. Did you really believe when you were there at 18, did you feel that made a difference, that your prayers mattered?
Yes, very much so.
And that God intervened on your behalf?
Yes.
And you're there for 4 days, and then you go back on your ship?
And you guys were then going to learn some new skills for underwater demolition?
Yes. We went to Maui and trained with the demolition team.
And the reason for that was there had been catastrophic losses with some of the UDTs?
Many of the losses.
And their job was to go in before everyone else, go underwater, see if there were coral reefs that were going to inhibit landings, blow them up, and in the process likely encounter opposition.
Yeah, you wait till the invasion. Uh-huh. You get all the information, and then as the invasion starts, you go in and blow those corals up. That's what happened in France when all those LCVPs and landing craft landed. All the army ran out, and they ran in deep water and drowned.
Yeah. Or in the Pacific, the famous example is Tarawa, where the coral reef hung up the landing craft, and they had to wade so far in that the Japanese were just mowing them down.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm just trying to wrap my head around this, though. You experience all this chaos in the early days of the Okinawa invasion, and then you decide, I want a more dangerous job, and I want to train for underwater demolition?
You just accept the position they put you in.
You didn't have to volunteer?
I said, oh, this group has had a lot of training in water. Most of us had, but swimming and lifeguard training.
Uh-huh.
So we can take them, and it won't take much to teach them to do the things we need to do. Mm-hmm. They're not afraid of the water.
Tell me some of the training that you guys went through, because now we're familiar with some of the things the Navy SEALs do, but this is 70 years ago, and I've talked to frogmen who said, yeah, we had swim trunks and flippers and goggles, and that was
That's about it.
That was our uniform.
A knife on your leg.
A knife on your leg.
That's it.
No shirt.
No shirt. Every 3 days, you'd go out and swim 3 miles back to shore.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes the current in between those islands would go in the wrong direction, so you'd all at once change and you'd go back the other way.
Uh-huh.
You might get in, and they wouldn't come and look for you until 6 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
If you didn't get in by 6 o'clock, they'd send the boat out to see where you were. So
yes.
You'd swim all night long getting back.
That training itself was life-threatening.
Yeah. Then you go out and you blow up coral, which you can't do anymore. Maybe if in the wars you could do it. We'd go out and set the charges and blow them up, and all the native people, what they did is they blocked off the road going up to where the farms were.
Uh-huh.
And nobody could go up there but the farmers. So they just took a base there. And the farming people, we'd have to notify them we're going to blow it up so they didn't get scared.
Yeah.
And they'd come down with their head baskets, and when the fish would come up, they'd go out and pick up the fish. And then after they did that, they'd clean them, and then they'd fix them for us at night.
So
the chef would make everything else for dinner.
Uh-huh.
And the whole families would come down. Well, not too many families, but the families would come down and have dinner with us and show a movie. And
so this is on Maui?
On Maui.
It's after the Okinawa invasion. You guys are training. You're learning all these skills for underwater demolition. What kind of explosives did you have?
We had dynamite. They built a little pier there.
Uh-huh.
And it's about 15, 20 feet above the water. And you'd throw that down into the boat when you were going to go out. You'd throw it down, and everybody's scared. Oh, what happens if you don't catch it?
Yeah.
Well, sometimes you don't catch it because it's not thrown in the right direction, you know. It won't blow up unless it's got an outside source of ignition.
Right.
So you didn't worry too much.
But then you go out in these boats?
Rubber boats.
Rubber boats with a little outboard motor?
Yeah.
And find the right spot above the reef?
Most of the time it was paddles. You didn't have a motor.
Oh,
you had to paddle it.
Rowing yourself out there with dynamite.
Yeah. Go down and set the charges.
Uh-huh.
Then everybody would get off the boat, hang on the side, because you don't stay in the boat because it's going to go up with the explosion.
Yeah.
If you get too far away from the source of ignition, you don't set off the dynamite. So you sit right practically over the top of it. And when you blow it up, the boat goes up. And the one guy in the boat, he's trying to keep the boat righted, but he always sit offside and it tips over. And about the last minute, you dive out, you know. It seems like it's fun, but, you know, it's dangerous, but it's fun.
Well, you're here in Southern California. Maybe Disneyland or someone can make a ride out of that. hiding the rubber boat and set off the explosion and see if you can stay in the boat.
Yeah.
So you guys are then just in the water waiting for the explosion and ready to ride these waves.
You get on the boat, put your back down because your back can stand a lot of explosion.
Yeah.
Don't stand front forward.
And how close to the charges?
You're right over the top where you're blowing up.
So it's maybe, what, 50 feet below you or something?
20 100? Feet.
20 feet.
Yeah, because you don't go deep water because you don't need to blow anything up deep water. You need it shallow water to make the channel way.
So what would happen when the charge went off?
Blow it up. Big mound of water would come up and all the shrapnel or the coral would come up and the fish would come up. And
So it's like a big water spout.
Yeah.
So the fish, since they're killed by the explosion, are just floating on top of the surf.
Yeah.
And so the
native people would pick them up.
They just go out there with a net or a basket and scoop them all up.
And they'd wade out there, maybe chest high,
uh-huh,
in the water and pick up all the fish and fix us dinner.
That's about the easiest fishing you can ever have, huh?
Yeah.
So then you guys would have fresh fish and some great feasts there in Hawaii. But the whole reason you're doing this is America is preparing to invade mainland Japan.
Right.
And you guys would be the first guys in.
That's it. You got to make the channel way so they get the boats in.
How did you feel about that?
Blessed that you were given the opportunity to learn to do that for America.
We'll pick things up right there when we come back from this next break. What George Chrisman remembers about the closing days of World War II and the unique and dangerous way he used some of those skills he honed during his Navy days in his post-war career with Chevron. All that and more when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
50 years ago, a war began that would change our nation and the lives of all involved.
One of our C-47s went down behind enemy lines. We will go in there and bring them home.
A father's mission then.
You're more than welcome to read my Bible.
Jesus loves you.
Would lead two men on a future journey.
We're driving to D.C. to see our father's name on the Vietnam Wall.
The answers I'm looking for in D.C., but they're not names on a wall.
To find the truth that had been hidden for years.
You know, I have no idea how my dad died.
From the studio that brought you God's Not Dead, Faith of Our Fathers, starring Stephen Baldwin, Kevin Downs, David A.R. White, with Cy Robertson and Candace Cameron Bure.
Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends.
Faith of Our Fathers, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13. Now playing. Find a theater at faithofourfathersmovie.com.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is George Chrisman, 88 years old, of Northridge, California. He served in the Navy during World War II. We heard about those four action-packed days on the shore of Okinawa at the outset of that bloody battle, and his subsequent training in underwater demolition. He was preparing for the invasion of Japan, which thankfully never became necessary.
Knowing what you know now about how prepared Japan was, to what degree the Japanese people were committed to defend the homeland, and what the estimates were of potential American casualties if that invasion had happened, how do you feel about what you would have been doing?
Good, because America's further ahead than any of the countries.
But
at that time.
Do you think you'd be sitting here talking to me today if the invasion had happened?
That's up to God.
Yeah? You might have found a way, huh?
Yep.
But instead, President Truman gave the order to employ this new technology and drop the atomic bomb. Do you remember when you heard about that?
August the 6th, they dropped Hiroshima.
You were still in Hawaii?
Yep. August the 9th, they dropped it on Nagasaki. 14th, they surrendered.
Was that a mind blower when you found out about this bomb?
We knew something was going on. Because they disbanded the teams and we were sent back to Oahu where we boarded the ships. I went on to an LSD-26, Tortuga. We knew, why did they disband the demolition team and send us back to Oahu? This is about a week or so before.
Ah.
Why are they stopping our training when this is going on? You can't figure out what's going on. And they couldn't tell anybody.
But you soon knew.
Soon knew after they blew it up.
Where were you when you heard the Japanese had surrendered?
In Oahu.
That must have been quite a party.
It was. All the ships shining in the air. It was the worst 4th of July you ever saw. The sky was full of those tracer bullets.
Yeah? And where were you? Were standing on the deck or what?
No, I was still on land.
Oh, you were ashore.
I hadn't gone to ship yet.
Uh-huh. So you're what? You're on Waikiki Beach watching this fireworks show?
Yeah, in the campground there.
And all these ships are lighting everything off and shooting red tracer bullets in the sky.
Better than any 4th of July I've seen.
Uh-huh. I could see how that would be hard to forget.
Yeah.
And what a place to see that, the place where, from America's perspective, the war began.
Yeah.
Right there on Oahu.
That's where it is.
What do you remember about what that meant to you and how that made you feel?
Hallelujah.
Yeah.
It's over. Good. Mm-hmm. I'm still alive.
Were there times where you thought you might not see your family again?
Oh, yeah. You never know when those big things go on.
Let's talk about this flag. You still have this flag today. I'll put a photo of it at hometownheroesradio.com on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll put a little video there of Mr. Christmas showing us the flag. There's a pretty neat story with that flag. You showed it to a young lady a few years ago?
I had a neighbor that's about 12 years old, the girl.
Uh-huh.
And her father says, "Do you remember anything about World War II?" And I said, "Yeah, a little bit." She said, "Well, she's going to write a thing of history class about World War II." So I went through her and showed her and did everything with the landing at Okinawa. And when the war ended, stuff like that, and she wrote it up. And she had a picture of her with this Japanese flag. She got first in a group there in Los Angeles. And she went to San Francisco and got first in the state for her essay. And they thought that was so great that they sent her back to Washington. And she got first in there. And they gave her, I think it's 5 or 6 years scholarship for her essay.
All because of you and your flag?
Yep. All because of her writing.
I guess so. But I bet that had to make you feel pretty special.
Yeah, it did. Very enlightening.
Well, and, you know, that's one of the reasons this show is on the radio, because most of the people alive today were not alive during World War II, and we have no idea what life was like back then. So here you're helping a young lady understand it, and her explanation of that does something outstanding for her, not to mention all the other lives it touched. And I understand here where you live. What do they call this place? The Village?
Village of Northridge.
The Village of Northridge.
Great place. It's like a palace.
It is. It's an impressive place. And you're a pretty popular guy. You give a lot of talks around here, don't you?
I do Memorial Day, 4th of July, and Veterans Day.
What do you talk about?
The meaning of Memorial Day. And at the end of the Memorial Day service, I give a little poem. It's called Dear Loved Ones. I do that because on Memorial Day, it's for all the people that were passed away during the war.
Yeah.
And at the end, I like to end up with a memorial for everybody in my life that's passed away, not necessarily service people.
Uh-huh.
And his poem is well written, and it's very touching. Anybody in the group that lost a member of their family during the war, serving our country, keeping us free, and keeping us safe, if they were in the Army, please raise your hand for recognition. And we recognize those people that passed away, their families passed away. And we go to the Army, the Navy, the Marines, all the way down to the Coast Guard, and then we end up singing Star Spangled Banner.
Mm-hmm.
And I pass out songs because everybody knows the songs of the Navy and the Marines and all those things, but they don't remember them well enough to sing them.
Yeah, they know the tune but not the words.
Yeah, so I pass out all the handout that gives them the words, even the Star Spangled Banner they can't remember. You know, America. I start out with America the Beautiful.
Yeah.
And then I go on from there.
Why do you do that?
Because it's dear to my heart to recognize all these veterans that have passed away serving our country, our great country.
And so many of the veterans that I talk to will tell me that something they learned during their time in the military proved pivotal for their life after the war. And for you, your diving experience with the Navy, when you're training to do this underwater demolition, all the diving you did, that is the reason that you ended up doing what you did for Chevron, right?
Yeah.
Tell me about that. You get done with the war, and how did you end up working for Chevron?
My neighbors worked at Chevron. It seemed like when everything was going down bad and the jobs weren't there, Chevron kept people working.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted to work for the company that was stabilized. And then they found out about my certification in diving, so they used me for the diving.
So tell us what you did, because I don't think many people have done this either. What kind of diving did you do, and what was the purpose?
Well, every time you have a pipeline or a loading facility, you have an underwater shutoff that they can shut off from the beach in case the ship moves around in storm or something, breaks the pipeline, it lets the oil go. They can shut it off from the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to go down and inspect that facility.
That's a pretty important job. I mean, we've seen here in recent years and just the last few weeks here in California that oil spills can do a lot of damage.
Oh, yeah.
Can harm a lot of things. So you're the one who's saying, yeah, this is secure, this is safe, this is okay to use. That's a lot of responsibility, isn't it?
Yes. In Chevron, they have an oil spill group. They've got 3 boats that go out on the oil spill. If the ship happens to dump oil,
yeah,
they call you and you can take the ship out and surround the oil spill with the boom.
Uh-huh.
And then you scoop it up with the shovels, and then they pick the barrels up with a helicopter and take it in, dump it.
Were you involved with that too?
Yeah.
So you had to do that a couple times?
Many times. And Red Adair, you know Red Adair down the bay?
Red Adair, the legendary oil well firefighter. If you've ever seen the John Wayne movie, The Hellfighters, from the late 1960s, John Wayne's character in that film is based on Red Adair, who put out more than 2,000 oil or natural gas-related fires before his death in 2004. He, too, was a World War II veteran. In fact, it was his work with a bomb disposal unit in the war that led Red Adair to that career of fighting oil blowout fires. He was a larger-than-life figure in his hometown of Houston, Texas, and that's where you first worked with him, right?
Chevron has a loading facility down there, and they had that oil spill, big oil spill down there.
Uh-huh.
They didn't know how to shut it off. He can't put the fire out because the oil keeps coming.
Right.
So I went down there and went underneath the oil spill and found out what we needed, came back out, got the equipment they needed, went back under and shut the valve off, and then you swim back off under there and the oil dissipates, burns off.
Right.
So Red Adair was one that would get me there.
Uh-huh.
When they had the big oil spills over there in Iran, they wanted me to go over there, but they couldn't get a work permit, Chevron.
Ah.
So Red Adair came over here, and we went to Floor Industries, who did the loading facilities over in Iran, and we talked about it, and he took all the sketches and everything and went back over with his divers, and they went down and did what I told them to do, and they shut the oil off, and from there was put the fires out.
I'm just trying to understand. It sounds like you're saying that you have some kind of understanding or intuition about some of these mechanisms that other people just wouldn't have?
Yeah.
Or is it just a problem-solving ability? Or what is it that made you so imperative to have your knowledge applied to one of these projects?
Just God gave me the ability to have that little bit that it takes to think about something.
So they tell you what's happening, or you have a picture of what's happening?
You know the oil spill's coming out. You know what's going on. Because most of the time, they have a regular diver that inspects this equipment.
Right.
And when the divers, every now and then they have to get an unbiased diver to go down and inspect the equipment and sign off on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I do that.
So how long did you keep diving like that?
Till I was 73.
You kept diving till you were 73?
Well, just inspections. You know, that's not too bad unless you go to Oahu. And that's where when I went down there and tried to get back on the ship, the guys grabbed my arms and this boat came up. There's big swells there. The tug came up and hit my ribs and broke 3 ribs.
Ooh.
My wife said, I think you're getting too old to do that. So.
Wow. Otherwise, you might still be doing it, huh?
Well, I don't know. The insurance is so expensive once you retire. They don't charge by the hour or by the day. The insurance company says, okay, you're going to go down. We'll start your insurance now, and when you come up, we'll stop your insurance. That's very expensive. $3,000 or $4,000 for about 15 minutes.
That's crazy.
Well, it's what they have to do.
Yeah. Well, that tells you how dangerous it is.
Yeah.
So you got hurt worse diving at age 73 than you did on the beach at Okinawa when you were 18.
Yeah.
With regard to your Navy service, is there anything else that we didn't talk about that you think is important to mention?
Well, just that they do a great job. We got a great Navy. I didn't know that they had people like that. You know, you think about the Navy, you're going on a ship.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I didn't think about Beachmaster having communications, and you're going on the beach with him. You're not trained to run on the ship, you know.
Yeah.
They have all kinds of things. They always said, oh, yeah, beach party team 62. You must have had a lot of fun at beach parties, all the beer you could drink and all these parties. I said, no, don't believe that.
Wasn't a party for you.
Wasn't a party.
Almost killed you.
Especially one time when we was out on one of those 3-mile swims. We were coming back and just happened to have the trainer there with us. He'd go out once in a while with us because he liked to keep training.
Mm-hmm.
And he rounds us all up because that signal in the air, you know, to round up. We gather him around and he says, there's a bunch of big whales coming through here. He says, this is their trail. They go from here to there, and this is where they go through. And he's around saying to us, oh, and we're all thinking, oh, Jonah the whale, you know, you're going to get swallowed. You're going to get chewed up. And he says, the only thing you have to worry about is when they go by, double on your back so they don't hit you in the stomach and knock the wind out of you. And he says, they will never come together. The big water, wave of water comes in the middle. You might get shot out of there like a pea. But he says, just don't worry about it. They'll be gone in a minute. And truthfully, you know, they just went right on by. He says they're not feeding when they're underway like that. They take water in and get a little food out of the water, but mm-hmm. That's all. He says, don't worry about being eaten like you see in the show.
Well, that had to be a little surreal, having a big old whale swim right next to you.
Yeah,
huh?
It's pretty scary.
I guess so. Well, you had a few scary experiences. But before I forget, I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it. Is there anything that you think those of us who were not alive in World War II need to know about you and all those other millions of Americans who were fighting for our freedom and, in reality, saving the world?
We just did what the people are doing now. They're saving our country, keeping us safe and keeping us free. And we thank them all for all the service they're doing.
Amen.
We have many in the service now that's keeping our country free. Thank God.
Amen. What are you most proud of?
Greatest country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Being an American. Can't beat that. Be proud of that. Don't try to tear the country down. Try to build it up. Let's all get along. Try to treat one another like we'd like to be treated.
Golden rule, huh?
Yep. Doesn't worry about what color or race or whatever. This is the greatest country because of the difference in races and colors.
Those words are relevant today and every day. George Chrisman, 88 years old, clearly a humble man, a pretty remarkable man. Check out hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for some photos of Mr. Chrisman. And join us again next time when we hear from a female veteran of World War II. We're out of time on Hometown Heroes for today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.